His answer was, "I'm not worried about that because the owner has 9 Wendy's franchises." I said, "Well, I appreciate that, but how does that mean we're going to get paid back on the millions of dollars that we've lent him to build the hotel?"
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your SMB spend with magical features, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Eric Segal from CFO Consulting Partners based out of Manhattan, New York, very glamorous. And today we're going to talk about community banking, fintech, and what it is, you know, to pick a CFO firm that has the right level of expertise for the business that you are running. So Eric, thank you very much for coming on the show. Maybe you could open things up by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Yeah, thank you very much, James. Oh, one thing that people don't necessarily know about me is that I started my career out of college in the nonprofit theater in New York, which is the off-Broadway theater or the off-off-Broadway theater. You know, working as an administrative assistant and general helper in a theater tech space for a venerable theater company called the Phoenix Theater. Mm-hmm. Spent, you know, a few years just, you know, living in that space, which was quite interesting and quite fun.
So I'd imagine that was a pretty lucrative time in your life.
No, I was very poor. It was.
So what's that like? What's that world like? I've never been in theater, and I'd imagine, you know, well, I'd imagine in New York, it can't be totally destitute. And that is headline place, and the Phoenix Theater is well known. So tell me about the financial life. What was it like there, from a business perspective?
From a business perspective, this particular institution was funded by a wealthy individual who, you know, wanted to do it and actually created one of the signature off-Broadway theater companies of the 20th century, really. But, you know, it was a nonprofit and we didn't get paid very much, but we had a lot of fun. I mean, you're working with famous actors, famous directors, famous set designers, people who do Broadway and TV and movies all the time. Famous playwrights was the Phoenix's focus was on developing playwrights, and famous playwrights like the late Wendy Wasserstein, who wrote Uncommon Woman and others, which was first premiered at the Phoenix Theater, and famous actors and actresses like Meryl Streep, early in their careers. And, you know, I got to hang on as a young kid in that mix. You know, nobody noticed me until there was an emergency and I had to solve something, but got to have a window into how that half of the world lived. It was quite fun.
Very good. So, I mean, my son grows up now. I wonder if I should recommend, would you recommend your parent, your kids go do something? I mean, I imagine myself at 20 years old, that sounds like a hell of a time to do. Maybe some life experience, put hairs mm-hmm. in my chest, maybe.
It's fun, you know, and one of the formative experiences at the working in the theater or probably any other a similar industry is, you know, there's a saying that the show must go on. It's a bit wrong. It's the show will go on and you best have your act together when it does. So,
I like it.
So, you know, in terms of understanding how to manage your time and focus and prioritize things to be able to achieve deadlines and, you know, not be fazed by various things that show up to distract you or distract everybody from actually getting the thing ready by 8 o'clock that evening, or, you know, if in business by Tuesday, if your boss needs something, it's really quite curative for the anxieties that you might otherwise feel. Cause it's like, oh, well, I remember that time when the production was this and this, and we solved it this and this way, and this is easy. You know, doing this report by Tuesday is easy compared to what we just did. So it's really a confidence builder for your skills and abilities.
I absolutely love that. That's fantastic. So you ran away from the circus to join the business school. Why'd you do that?
I was poor.
Business school was money. Okay.
And business, well, you know, you can't really live in Manhattan. You know, my parents were quite generous, but you can't really live in Manhattan, even back then in the early 80s, on $150 a week. You know, you can try, but it gets tiresome. So, you know, my goal was to go to business school, get an MBA, and then join, you know, a larger entertainment industry enterprise, like a television network or a movie studio or something right. like that. It didn't work out that way. I ended up going into financial services, but you know, that's the way that worked out.
Very good. So in Ireland, anyway, here, when someone tells me they're in financial services, I expect them to start trying to sell me an insurance policy fairly soon after that. But tell me, what does financial services really mean in the corporate perspective?
The way my firm, CFO Consulting Partners, and our team defines financial services is companies which provide financial services to individuals, corporations, you know, they do deposit gathering, lending, or facilitating of payments, et cetera. So what that means to us is banks, fintechs, cryptocurrency companies, asset management companies like wealth management firms or hedge funds or venture capital funds, and also, you know, the insurance companies, but at the corporate level, not necessarily selling insurance. And what those companies do is facilitate individuals and corporations access to payment systems, access to borrowings, access to, you know, deposits, et cetera. That's what financial services means to us. There's also a group of folks in there that will sell you an insurance policy or three or four.
Right. Okay. Ruin it for everyone else. So okay. And then you have a pretty big name on your CV earlier on with Moody's. So that must have been a pretty I'd imagine there's some pretty interesting roles there. What were you doing with Moody's?
At Moody's, I was an analyst in the banking and finance group, which included savings and loans. And at that point in history, and focusing mostly on savings banks, at that point in history, the U.S. was having what was referred to as the S&L crisis. A lot of these savings banks were failing and blowing up across the country. And it was, again, a very formative time for me because at Moody's, CEOs and CFOs of major firms want you desperately to understand their business and see it in the best light. So they will spend hours, days with you and the team at Moody's to help you understand that business. You can ask questions and you're treated. You can't let it really go to your head, but you're treated as a peer. And early on in my career, I got to sit down with the likes of Sandy Weill, who outlined his plans for buying one company called Commercial Credit, and then how he was going to take that company and expand it into what eventually became Travelers, which eventually then merged with Citi. And he outlined all his strategy for us and was very interested in us understanding it so that we would have a positive view of Commercial Credit, which he clearly needed as the initial platform. And he thought he had a lot more to say to us, so he came back the next day. So it was, I don't know, in my case, it's after business school, postgraduate study work with CEOs and CFOs of major corporations. My experience at Moody's, you know, that educational part aside, that was fascinating, but my experience at Moody's was providing ratings and analysis for these savings and loans, which were really on the brink of total chaos and disaster, many of them. And, you know, you could see inside the difficulties that these institutions were having and what some people did that worked, some people did that didn't work, some things they did that didn't work. So it was really fascinating.
So a question about that. So in today's market, you know, a lot of people say, well, there's no value in this stock market. All the information is out there in the stock market, and it's just the computers trading with each other more or less, and there's no alpha to be had, let's say. Do you think that's true, or was it more so? It sounds like when you're going belly to belly with these people, arguably, it was kind of an interesting perspective to get insight that, you know.
Based on my experience at Moody's and inside a large corporation later at American Express and inside my practice, there's plenty of alpha. There's different ways as you assess the competencies and capabilities of management. And as you assess the peculiarities of individual accounting policies, accounting treatment, and more specifically, the more driving to what's going on with the business is their customer-facing staff, whether it's a commercial lending officer or even retail branches for banks or, you know, business development people for our fintech clients. You know, do they do that well or do they do that bad? And how do they accomplish that? I mean, if you can get in and do analysis on that, you'll find differentiators all over the place.
Very interesting. Okay, well, let's go skip through because we've got an interesting story to talk about your first sort of interim CFO job, but we should cover off here. You went on then to Treasury with American Express. What did you learn from your time there? And maybe you could just give us a quick tour of what you ended up doing over that time.
Yeah, well, I was at Moody's, and as I mentioned, the savings and loans were my bailiwick, but they were very quickly going away. So I, you know, my career at Moody's would be to migrate into being an analyst at banks, which is interesting, but not really my cup of tea. I don't want to, because banks are pretty cookie cutter in their approach. And I heard of this job in Treasury at American Express, and I thought, boy, that would be a fascinating place to be. It's big, lots of opportunity, tremendous amount of things to do. And so I interviewed and I got the job. I spent my thumbnail sketch of my career at American Express is spent about 6 years in Treasury doing risk management work, you know, applying my credit skills to their counterparties. Then I was the CFO of a online broker dealer they were developing called American Express Financial Direct. And then I went to the International Bank to work as a head of business analysis and later as the CFO of the wholesale side of that bank. And then I went to be the CFO for consumer banking at American Express, which that became part of the Ameriprise spinoff, and was able to participate in building a bank for Ameriprise, which was, again, a tremendously informative opportunity. So, yeah, I guess my instinct was right. It was a big place to have a lot of opportunity and a lot of interesting and, frankly, fun things to do.
Very good. So let's get into the meat of it here. So your first interim job, having had this career, which obviously gave you the kudos and gravitas to be able to take this on, was with a struggling community bank. Mm-hmm. So maybe set the scene here. Tell us a bit about community banks, because it's quite different in the US mm-hmm. to Europe, I guess. And yes. Community bank here, we have things called credit unions, which are kind of local bank, you know, lending organizations, mm-hmm. and we have, you know, five or six banks nationally, but we don't really have this heritage of community banks. So give us a bit of a texture of what that industry is like.
Yeah. America's banking system developed, you know, sort of a decentralized manner. You know, the larger banks, you know, Citi, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, grew up in commerce centers. You know, they were once upon a time called money center banks. Yeah. Throughout the country, there need for banking services that these folks just, you know, even historically were not providing. And other banking institutions grew up, and a regulatory regime grew up in the government. And you had, you know, currently today, there are 4,000 banks in the U.S., arguably the six big ones plus another couple hundred, you know, regionals like M&T and PNC. But, you know, you take those away and there's, yeah, thousands of smaller institutions ranging in asset size from $50 million up to $20 billion in total assets, which spend time providing lending and deposit service and access to payment systems for communities, you know, yeah. Small cities, smaller places. In some places, in agricultural communities, they might be the only financial institution for hundreds of miles with a physical location. So it's proven to be the way the population likes to do banking. You know, when your bank, your community bank gets purchased by a mega bank or a regional bank at this point in time, you know, clients feel like, oh, you know, I used to be able to go and, you know, sure. And see, you know, Joe or Mary and talk about my business and talk about my issues, and they'd work with me on solutions. Now I'm calling a call center in Charlotte and they could give a crap, you know?
Yeah.
So you get that push, so, you get that involvement.
Yeah. So these community banks, then the numbers can get a bit mind-boggling if you're not used to it. So, you know, you say on the lower end, $100 million bank, or, you know, what would that be the equivalent to of like a traditional business? Like, for example, the owner there, would they be, you know, what sort of net profit, if you like, would that sort of bank throw off every year?
That bank might throw off, you know, a return on equity of 10%. So the equity is, so a $100 million bank, there's $10 million of equity and it gets a 10% or 14% return on equity. So that's $1.5 million, $2 million net profit, something like that.
Okay. All right. So an SMB effectively.
Yeah. But, all right. If we scale it up a little bit, a $2 billion bank, you know, or, you know, throwing off decent net profit, would also employ 300 people and provide service to, you know, significant geography that they might not be able to get elsewhere. So it's, you know, community is not a term that I always think that, you know, it's not just a throwaway term in the nature of these banks. They're really working in the community and they're doing a lot of stuff.
So tell me about this first fractional client you had. What was the setup?
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, it's hard to say. You know, we had a financial crisis in 2008 and 2009. And that was causing a significant pressure on the overall economy and significant pressure on the banking sector specifically. The term bankers use is asset quality, which basically means people can't pay the loans back. So asset quality is declining. You know, the probability of getting paid back on your loans is decreasing as there's more stress in the economy. That was the moment in which I joined CFO Consulting Partners to build a financial services practice along the lines we discussed, you know, banks, fintechs, insurance companies, and asset managers. And what was happening in the marketplace is that these particular community banks that we discussed were stressed, and not just the CFOs, but really nobody in the bank had really in the banking sector in that place, not nobody, but many of the professionals hadn't really seen that kind of stress on their financial situation before. And literally were just saying, it's not for me, I'm leaving. So in this particular bank, that's what happened. The CFO was all these things going on. And then you had regulators, both the bank regulators and the Securities and Exchange Commission, asking questions. You had customers asking questions. This particular bank had recently bought a mortgage banking operation, which in that particular moment in time was not performing as well. And capital was running thin. So they entered into an agreement to be bought by another bank. Yeah, White Knights. But the transaction couldn't go through because both the bank regulators and the Securities and Exchange Commission had all sorts of questions about the existing financial condition, the underlying financial condition, what ultimately became my client. So that CFO was like, no mas, I'm done.
Right.
And
which is warning sign number one, right? So when you're...
Yeah. Well, it's also, you know, when people grow up in, and as our experience at CFO Consulting Partners is, when people grow up in any industry, particularly a small, medium-sized business, as you said, an SMB, they learn how to do things, you know, and oftentimes just one step at a time. What value we bring and the thing I learned, as we talked about in the theater and at American Express and at Moody's, is, you know, how to manage and how to live with multiple complex work streams. Mm. And in this case, those multiple complex work streams were, I've got a buyer. I have a transaction that has to go through. I have the bank regulators, which want certain things. I have the auditors who need to get satisfied in order for work stream one to get complete, work stream two and three. And then we have the Securities Exchange Commission who are asking questions about prior filings, and they had to get satisfied all to get the thing done. So all those things that were done simultaneously. And that was just not in the experience of that incumbent CFO. And they moved on.
So, but at the same time, I'm guessing not everything was rosy's. SEC had questions for a reason. So what was your process and what did you find?
You know, in economic times like that, the driving force of bank distress is, as we talked about, asset quality, loans going bad, people not paying back, or not being able to pay back. It's not necessarily malicious. It's just, they don't have the wherewithal. If times had always been good, or for a long time, you know, things had been good, the banks don't necessarily have a good system for tracking and managing, a robust platform for managing and tracking those assets as they decline. And what happened to this particular bank is that they came to the realization, probably with the assistance of their auditors, who said, hey, you've got an asset quality problem here you're not recognizing. And they recognized a write-off of $30 million in one quarter. That's a lot of money. It's a, you know, $1 billion, $2 billion bank. That's a lot of money. And that's a lot of earnings that they had to, you know, where they were not going to get and had to cease accruing the earnings on, the interest on. And so the question that the SEC asked is, we noticed in your filing, your 10Q, that you wrote down $30 million in loans. Can you tell us, did all those loans go bad in this quarter? Because as far as the SEC is concerned, you're supposed to be monitoring your loans and writing them off as they happen. And, you know, $30 million for Citibank in one quarter is just one office building, right? $30 million for a community bank is a lot of medium-sized loans. So they're like, well, how did those, are you sure those loans all went bad this quarter? Please prove it to us. And the fact is, they didn't. They had been bad previously, just nobody, they didn't have the platform to recognize them and understand that they had been bad. Right. They didn't understand they weren't getting payments or the payments were spotty or things like that until they all piled up. So the process there was to figure out, in answer to the SEC's question, when did the loans go bad? And that meant really, for myself, that meant really using my credit training from Moody's to dive into the credit files and start to sort things out into, you know, various piles. This loan's decline should have been recognized 2 quarters ago, this one last quarter, this one in the current quarter, and sort them into piles so that we would have to be able to answer the SEC. And the fact was, no, some of those loans went bad a quarter ago, 2 quarters ago, 3 quarters ago, and we have to restate the financials accordingly.
Right. Okay. And that's a significant issue, right, for the SEC. Restating is not good news if you're a bank, especially if you're trying to do a merger.
Well, the SEC won't approve the merger until the restated financials are complete and accepted, right. I guess. And so that became another work stream is let's get the financials. And there are complicated accounting rules involved in restatements, especially when you're dealing with bad loans. But let's get the financials in place so that we can redo our quarterly filings.
Right.
And then we have to, but to do that, you have to get that all in place. And then you have to work with your auditors so that they will sign off on them. And then you have to also work with the regulators because suddenly the capital that they thought you had 3 quarters ago is not the capital that you had.
Right. So the regulators in this case is the...
In this case was the OCC, the Office of Comptroller of Currency, because this was a national bank. There's a kind of funny regulatory system in the U.S., but...
So what are those different groups like to work with as a whole? Are they coming down to the office? Are they sending you letters? Are you working through lawyers? Is there a, you know, personal relationship you can work with, so to speak? Or what was that experience like?
All of that. Typically, the SEC communications are coming through law firms. Yeah, our lawyers are talking to the SEC. I mean, the SEC will send us a letter, would send you a letter saying, yeah, we have questions about this. And then you say to your lawyer, can you go find out what they really mean about these questions so we can answer them?
Right.
And then you work with your lawyer to craft the response so that you're doing it as they need it. The regulators, the bank regulators are much more personal experience. And if the bank regulators will, for a bank's regular exam, and certainly for a bank that's stressed like this, they will show up and ask for a conference room and stay there. And they will be part of your fabric of your day-to-day. You know, you'll see them at the coffee pot. You'll see them in the lunchroom. They will be, and they will ask for things to review things. And they will be, I don't think physically looking over your shoulder, but spiritually looking over your shoulder too, so that they're comfortable and assured that what you're telling them, we're making progress on getting our arms around this. Well, they want to see that up close and personal. So they will be there. The auditors the same way. They, you know, auditors do field work, but in a situation like this where you're restating three quarters, their field work is never ending. So they're there. They are there frequently and often with, you know, questions. And everybody's got a slightly different focus. All of those three entities have a slightly different focus. So developing the relationships is key. Providing the information timely and accurately is important. And deliver and fundamentally doing what you say you're going to do is
right.
Don't set expectations. Don't say, oh, we can do this by Thursday and you can't get it done. Be realistic and making sure, you know, just like, you know, do what you say you're going to do is the most important part of managing these relationships.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's it. It's so simple. Do what you say you're going to do. If you do only that, you'll go far in life, but it's dramatically, surprisingly difficult to achieve sometimes. Mm-hmm. So, okay, well, let's go back to the root of the $30 million in bad loans that weren't recognized on time, I guess. And maybe you mentioned the culture and how important the culture is in these small banks. Tell us more about that culture and how did that culture have an impact on the decision not to recognize the loans in a timely fashion?
Yeah, I don't think it was a decision so much as not to recognize the loans, so much it was a lack of experience in understanding that the loans were not going to pay.
But when you say that, I mean, isn't it just, well, they haven't paid us for 3 months? Like, isn't there like a, where's the wiggle room there? What, how do you know?
Yeah, I'll give you the answer I got from another client.
Yeah,
not this particular client, but one client had a loan to a businessman, but it was really to a hotel he was building. Okay. And the hotel was built to take advantage of an interstate exit that was going to be built.
Right.
But the interstate exit was never built. So here's a hotel.
Oh, right.
In the middle of a very nice section of the country, the Northeast.
Yeah.
But you know, it wasn't a destination hotel. It was more like a Holiday Inn or something like that, Holiday Inn Express or Hampton Inn. You know, nobody was going to go there for a vacation, but, and so he had this property that was not cash flowing. And I said to the chief credit officer of that institution, well, how are we going to get paid back on that? And his answer was, well, I'm not worried about that because the owner has 9 Wendy's franchises.
Right.
I said, well, I appreciate that, but how does that mean we're going to get paid back on the millions of dollars that we've lent him to build the hotel? You might you might provide some degree of cash flow service for the loan, but you're not going to necessarily get paid back on your principal. And the answer was, but he has 9 Wendy's franchises. So some of the community banking relationships, you know, and the skills that those individuals, the credit individuals had, were not really evolved enough to deal with periods of high stress. You know, when 1 + 1 doesn't necessarily equal 2, you're not going to get paid back on the loan. You might get serviced on the debt. So you have to figure out what the right treatment of this loan is. And you might have to write down the value of this loan and take a loss on it because you're never going to get your $6 million back. So what are you going to get back? And the industry in 2008, 2009, in some of these banks, that one I worked at in particular, we had not evolved to thinking like that, number one. Number two, this particular bank's culture and many of the medium-sized businesses, whether banking or not, that you run into, had been run by one particular individual who told everybody what to do. Right. Unfortunately, sadly, that individual passed away suddenly.
Right.
And there was nobody to tell anybody what to do. And so they, you know, that individual, I've never met him, as I understand it, would say, well, wait, we're going to see some stress here. Let's take a look at the loan portfolio and figure out what our write-offs should be this quarter. He was very hands-on and very directive. Without him in his seat, the place was a bit at sea. We see that frequently in our practice, both in banking and, you know, frequently in smaller community banks. And, you know, as you can imagine, let's say in a manufacturing company that's dominated by the owner, he tells everybody what to do. And if he were to vanish, a lot of people would not know what to do. So this was the case here in this particular bank, and has been the case in other banks we've worked in, is a dominant personality, the CEO and chairman, told everybody what to do, managed everything and micromanaged everything on a day-to-day basis, and things were fine. Nobody had to think for themselves.
Okay, well, now let me bring it on to your practice, I guess. You've alluded to the fact there that you work today with community banks, but tell us a bit more about your practice and what makes it different from others out there, that CFO consulting partners.
Our focus is on providing a high level of service to our clients. We're not a staffing firm. We're not just putting in bookkeepers or accountants. When I joined the firm, there were 8 of us. Now there are 25 of us in the ensuing 15 years. And all of the team have Big 4 experience, Fortune 500 experience, or both. Many of our team are CPAs. I'm not, but many of our team are. And we have significant experience across the disciplines of accounting, reporting, planning and analysis, and strategic planning. And so we can provide clients as a team with all of the expertise they need in the office of the CFO that they wouldn't be able to get or necessarily afford from a larger firm, like a Big 4 accounting firm, or from a smaller firm, an accounting firm, a local accounting firm, or maybe even from an individual. There are a lot of sole practitioners out there. in my practice at CFO Consulting Partners, 8 of the 25 people work there in financial services. And we have people who are, I've got colleagues who are adept at particular financial reporting and technical accounting skills, planning and analysis, and, you know, balance sheet optimization and capital optimization techniques, and across banks, fintechs, asset managers. So we bring the whole team to every engagement. So in this case, at this initial bank that I was at, you know, there was something that needed to be done that nobody could do, because the people who had done this particular task, it actually was preparing the books and records for the employee benefits plan, preparing the financial statements, left. The bank was in trouble. People were finding other jobs. And the controller said to me, "We need somebody to do this. I don't have the time." And I said, "Okay, my colleague David will do it." One of the founders of the firm, David DeMuth. And he said, "I don't have the time to show David what to do." I said, "No, that's the whole entire point of CFO Consulting Partners. You don't have to show David what to do. Give him the material, put him in a conference room, and he'll create the financial statements for the employee benefit plans, and then you can give it to the auditors and it'll go smoothly." And I was greeted with some skepticism, but David showed up, grabbed the material, went into the conference room, actually took it back to our office, came back 2 days later, everything was complete, everything was done, and the auditors were very happy. And the controller was looking at me in kind of amazement. I said, "That's what we do. Yeah, we can solve those kind of problems very easily. And it's a good example of how we work as a team."
Very good. So that's a great explanation. Maybe you could just wind us up here by telling us, you know, how can people get in touch with you, or more importantly, who should get in touch with you?
I think anybody with anybody in the financial services space with a question on finance, accounting, or balance sheet management, or any sort of issues with, you know, wondering how they should proceed strategically with their finances, is welcome to call. Our website is cfoconsultingpartners.com. My particular email is esegal@cfoconsultingpartners.com. You can email me, you can go to the website and fill out a request for service. You can, you know, add comments and we'll get back in touch with you. You can pick up the phone and call. Our office in Princeton is 609-309-9307, or any way you want to get in touch, we're more than happy to respond. And, you know, as you and I talked about before, I'm unfortunately not the most astute businessman. I will spend 2 hours talking to somebody who's got some questions and unfortunately probably solve their problem before they need to engage us. But, you know, I'm happy to do that.
So a shout out to unscrupulous entrepreneurs out there who are looking to freebie on Eric's time.
Please call. Please call. We'll have great conversations.
All right, very good. Well, thank you very much for being on the show, Eric. I really enjoyed it. And thank you for listening this far. Your special reward is to be able to go to the grossprofitpodcast.com, go to the events section, where we hold monthly mastermind sessions with fractional CFOs. If you are a fractional CFO, it's a great session. You come along, we'll put you in a group with 3 or 4 of your peers, and we'll give you a worksheet where you can prepare a business problem that you're working on. It could be your practice development problem. It could be a client challenge, and you'll get feedback from other CFOs who are your peers in your industry, and a chance to get direct feedback, and also maybe pass on some advice for people who are a few steps before you. So they're a lot of fun. We had one last night. It was a big hit. So I recommend you check that out. And that's it. Thanks very much, Eric. This has been great.
Thank you very much for having me, James. It's been great. Thank you.